We'll hear argument first this morning in number 85-1384, William R. Turner versus Leonard Safley. Mr. Herschel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Initially, I'm going to go through a brief background of the status of the case and the facts. I will then proceed to the correspondence issue and then discuss the marriage issue. At present, unless there's questions concerning the findings of fact and conclusions of law, I'll leave those for the argument on the briefs. The issue in this case is prisons, specifically about the level of deference that is going to be given to prison officials to act upon legitimate security, legitimate security interests concerning the regulation of inmate-to-inmate correspondence and inmate marriages. This is a class action that was brought pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 1983, which challenged the Missouri Department of Corrections regulations concerning the inmate-to-inmate correspondence and inmate marriage problems. The district court found that those regulations were far more restrictive than necessary and held them unconstitutional. This holding was affirmed by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The challenges to the Missouri visitation regulation and a damage issues were found in favor of the defendants and were not appealed. The Renz Correctional Center is a complex prison. What I mean to say when I say a complex prison is that it's a co-correctional, multi-level security institution. At the Renz Correctional Center, at the time of this trial, we had male and female inmates. We had female maximum security inmates and medium security inmates, and male minimum security inmates. The Renz Correctional Center was also used to hide inmates within the system. For example, if somebody was concerned about their life or something along those lines, the Renz Center would be used to hide them because the minimum security men were located there. At the present time, we have undergone some changes. The Renz Correctional Center, medium security women have been moved to another institution along with a number of the maximum security. Eventually, there will be a maximum security unit for women at another location, and we will move the rest of the women who are now housed at Renz to that institution. However, Renz will always be a place where we'll have some women for medical care and for special security problems, but they'll never have the number of women that it had at the time of this trial, which was approximately 250. The issues are as follows. The correspondence issue, in effect at that time, did not permit correspondence between inmates in different institutions, whether it was in state or out of state, unless the adjustment classification team, which was a team of caseworkers who reviewed their files before they permitted anyone to correspond with any other inmate in another institution, unless it was in their best interest. In addition, they were permitted to correspond with relatives who are also incarcerated within the system. The marriage regulation did not permit the marriage of inmates unless the superintendent determined there was a compelling reason. In other words, the burden was on the inmate to come forward to the superintendent and present him with a compelling reason. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I believe the evidence would sustain that, is that basically it was a rather narrow interpretation. It was only going to be on the basis that there was a child involved through a previous relationship before they were incarcerated, that the prison official or the superintendent would permit the marriage while they were in prison. The appellant in this case requests the court permit deference to the prison officials, and that the court require that inmates prove that the prison officials have exaggerated the response to the penological interest before they determine that the regulation is overbroad or that it's over unconstitutional. The respondents, on the other hand, would burden the prison official to demonstrate a pattern of security concerns before the regulation could be upheld. Then there would be a determination of whether the exercise of the right involved, the inmate exercise, is in some way inherently dangerous or presumptively dangerous, and then the court would pick between competing reasonable alternatives or least restrictive alternatives to determine which alternative achieved this goal. There is no debate, even I don't believe there's any debate among the parties, that even a core right that the respondents have argued deserves a strict scrutiny can be restricted in some manner by the fact of incarceration. The question is, to what extent can we restrict the rights of inmates while they are incarcerated? This court, in previous First Amendment cases and prison cases, has used an analysis, I'm using this besides Pecuniary Martinez, has used an analysis which presented the least restrictive alternative, which presented the rational relation test. In this, by this examination, the court required that the decision of the correctional official be demonstrated to be an exaggeration, an exaggerated response to a legitimate penological interest demonstrated by substantial evidence on the record. In determining whether the response has been exaggerated, this court has examined a number of factors. They first identified the penological interest involved, whether it was a security interest, rehabilitation of inmates, whether it was deterrence of crime, or the maintenance of internal order. The court would always identify. In the present case, the petitioners presented the security interest as the predominant interest in the upholding of our regulation between inmate correspondence. We also had some rehabilitation interest, but predominantly it was a security interest. We decided that this was an important issue because we feel that the control of communication between inmates in institutions is critical to our control of not only inmate violence, but inmate gang control and various other security interests that we would have in isolating inmates between institutions in Missouri. For example, in Missouri, we do have 13 institutions, and we have the ability to move them around. The second interest and the most important interest that this court has examined is whether the regulation itself is content neutral. And in the present case, this regulation is content neutral. Once the regulation is approved, once the inmate is approved, and this was a prior approval, the inmate was then permitted to correspond. We did not in any way censor any of his correspondence in any way try to confine him to what he could write about the institution in any way. Finally, the regulation this court has always examined as a relevant factor whether there are alternative means of communication between alternative ways of achieving the communication. In this present situation, as to that individual inmate, if an inmate is prohibited from corresponding with another inmate, there will be no alternative means of communicating with that particular inmate. However, there will be alternative means of communication.
You don't really mean that, do you? Couldn't I write a letter to my mother and tell her to send it to Joe?
Yes.
How would you stop that?
As there is evidence of the trial, we stopped it by attempting to return the mail after we identified that this was a prisoner letter between a civilian and the insider. We would not censor the letter. We would return the letter.
What was in it?
We were permitted by regulations to scan mail coming into our institutions, and we would scan
them. And
there's
a difference between scanning and looking at it?
No difference between scanning and looking at it, but we'd have to look at it to determine whether or not they were circumventing the mail rule. Because the whole point of this was to control the correspondence between inmates, and if we couldn't control that, then they could always get around
us.
We would scan it whenever we felt there was a problem. Frankly, the number of letters coming into the institutions prohibit us from scanning every piece of mail, just as this regulation makes it possible for us to scan all the letters between the individual institutions. At the present time, we are under a regulation.
You only scan those you want to, those who are under your suspicion.
The present case, we under probable cause, yes.
That's right. And where do you get that right?
By the regulation that we determine that, where do we determine whether it's probable cause? All right. Well, we determine that by either determining through the informant system in the prison, determining whether something seemed irregular about the letter itself from the envelope, determining whether or not we have identified a person as a gang member. Those kinds of things are the things that we assess before you would scan a letter to determine whether or not you need to review it. At the present time, we have the right, as I said, to examine the letters and review the mail, but we found that it's very difficult because for every message we catch or every indication of problem we catch, we're concerned that we're missing some. For example, the Texas people indicated that they have problems with codes. May I
ask this question along the lines of your argument? Does the record show that, in fact, any mail was being committed between inmates?
Yes.
Does it indicate the extent of that mail that was approved?
Okay. The chief...
Does it indicate whether there were a dozen letters approved in a week or a dozen in a year?
His testimony, Mr. Engelbrecht's testimony, was that 25% of requests were approved.
Were approved.
He said that of that number, or of that group, he could review those letters in a period of about an hour a day. What we argue, and that was used in the Circuit Court opinion, the Eighth Circuit Court opinion, to say, well, you could easily take care of the reviewing the mail. Actually, our testimony was that we could review this mail, but if you permitted every inmate in all the institutions to correspond, we would find that very difficult to handle, and in fact, we have found some difficulty in it.
Mr. Herschel, does the record tell us what the volume of this inmate mail is?
We could only speculate on what it would be at that time, since we had never.
But does it tell us what it? What it has been at any point in time, the attempts to mail? Right?
It only tells you that of the mail that was approved by the individual team classification groups, that for example, at Wren's, with a population of 350 inmates, that it took them about an hour to review the mail had been approved. Now, not every inmate...
An hour every day or an hour a week or what?
An hour every day.
An hour every day, and so that must be... It doesn't tell us how many letters there were, whether they read it closely or scan it or what.
No, it doesn't tell you. He reviewed it on the basis of you know, when they found something suspicious or they found a letter that was going to an inmate that was not on the approval list, he would examine it and determine whether or not it was whether or not there was
one of the things that puzzles me about the case is I can't get a feel for the how much work is really involved here. I know in service during the war, they could go through an awful lot of mail in a fairly brief period of time, and they were looking for important stuff. But they don't know what the
difficulty with our position in the case, and since we had never permitted it, we didn't have an idea except to say that except that we had 8,000 inmates, and we figured that they would write, and that's the only kind of.
But they might not be writing to inmates in other institutions regularly, at least. I suppose they primarily write to their family and so forth.
We can speculate on that time. Now, Kansas, Sally Halford, Chandler of Kansas, testified that they had an open correspondence program and that they could not review all the mail. And they did not review all the mail because they felt they couldn't handle it. And I believe that's a fair assessment of her testimony.
Did her testimony tell us how much there was in Kansas?
No. Okay. And in dealing with an alternative means of communication, we would, as I said, prohibit...
Let me just ask one other question. In your principal argument why you must just say no mail unless you get advance permission is it would be too much trouble to review the volume that would take place.
Well, it's too much trouble not because we couldn't hire the people to do it, because you can always hire more people. I mean, it takes your resources away from something else, but you can hire more people.
Yeah.
Our problem is that we feel that the difficulty in reviewing each piece of mail in light of possible codes, in light of the increasing gang problem in the state of Missouri, would lead us open to having mistakes being made that would result in tragedy. If in this situation, if we catch a piece of mail, we've solved a problem. But for every one piece of mail we catch, we may miss one. And if we miss one, we have concerted
activity.
But
you have precisely the same risk that Justice Marshall identified, don't you, in the mail sending it to a civilian who in turn would pass the same message along to the inmate in the other institution. And the only way to catch that is to go through all mail, isn't it?
Well, it's a little bit different in the sense that you can begin to identify by the patterns of letters coming in what letters are going into the same inmate from the same civilian. For example, if the civilian starts to write 5 or 6 different inmates, you begin to get an idea that maybe they're using her as a conduit or being used as a conduit. That situation is slightly more specific, although a problem. I mean,
that's easier to handle than just looking at the direct inmate correspondence?
We believe it to be easier because we believe it to be less that basically most civilians won't get involved in that kind of a thing. I mean, we're basically, you're asking a civilian there to commit a act in violation of a regulation, in violation of that could conceivably take away her privileges or his privileges in dealing with the prison system ever again. I mean, if you violate a regulation as a civilian, you don't have a right back.
Doesn't most of your danger of some kind of illegal activity between an inmate, two inmates, one in one institution, one in another, planning some kind of an escape or something, wouldn't they almost always have to use a third party to help them with their plans?
Except it's so much easier using the third.
And if there's a third party involved, they just write to the third party who in turn writes to.
Well,
I have trouble.
They're going to have to get a third person involved in the thing and in the scheme, and it's going to have to be a civilian. And there would be an assumption there. I would assume that most civilians would not necessarily get involved in that thing, and that if you do have a group of civilians.
Yes, but if you have a potential escape with a third person civilian, obviously this is not an honorable civilian.
Correct.
By hypothesis, yeah.
Correct, but the system is not perfect. We cannot develop a perfect system without stopping all communication between outsiders and insiders.
You can make it harder, is what you're saying, isn't it?
Right.
You can't stop it entirely, but you can make it harder.
Right.
So they have to. And moreover, it isn't just escape you're worried about, is it? You're also worried about prison gangs,
right.
Assassinations in one prison being directed from another.
And very important.
And that doesn't require a civilian at all, does it?
No. What we're also very concerned about is the concerted action. And for example, the court in the Eighth Circuit said you're talking about correspondence that is not as presumptively dangerous as the assembly discussed in Jones v. Gorton, North Carolina, or the solicitation. And they said it wasn't as dangerous because you have separated prisons. Our argument is that it's more dangerous because we have separated prison. The danger of the assembly of inmates in Jones versus North Carolina was not that they assembled, but because they could perform and have concerted action, that they in some way could cause a disturbance that we could not handle. Permitting inmate-to-inmate correspondence between institutions permit them now to have concerted action in more than one institution. And we would then have to react, stretch our resources into more than one place. Now, granted, we haven't had a situation like that, but we are predicting, we are attempting to anticipate problems. If we don't anticipate problems in a prison situation and react to a problem in a prison situation, we are not going to successfully take care of it. We are going to have tragedy. And that's how prison officials deal with it. If we go to a least restrictive alternative analysis,
Your mail rules aren't just intended to decrease the volume. They do decrease the volume of mail that you have to review.
Yes.
But they also decrease, what you might say, the risk of the mail that has to be reviewed. That is, even though it may only be 25% the amount of mail, it's much less than 25% the amount of attention that you have to devote to that mail. Isn't that so? Because it's not coming from the most dangerous people.
We hope with our reviewing.
Well, that's the objective of the system, isn't it?
It's exactly.
So it isn't just a reduction in volume. It also makes it easier for you to review what reduced volume is produced.
And hopefully we have chosen the people who are going to be the least risk. And the difficulty with having free communication is it basically we are going to have to deal with not only bad people or people who are dangerous to us, but people who are going to attempt to get around any sort of inspection.
Mr. Herschel, is the same correspondence rule applied in all of Missouri's prisons?
When you
is
say
the same rule applied in all of Missouri's prisons as in the Renz Institution?
At this time, the best interest standard was applied. Now, certain institutions permitted correspondence more regularly. Renz was a minimum perimeter prison with maximum security inmates and minimum security inmates, and whereas the Missouri State Penitentiary...
But the general regulation
was the same.
Applied to all. It was administered differently at the Renz Institution. More restrictively?
More restrictively.
Do you know what the federal correspondence rule is for inmates to inmates?
It's inmates to inmates. It's prohibited correspondence unless... and they meet three or four different criteria, and I've forgotten the exact criteria. But I remember reading it last night. I just can't think of the exact words. But it's based on whether there's certain penological statements of benefit that would result from the correspondence between the inmates.
Mr. Herschel, could you get to the marriage point for a minute?
Yes,
two
sir.
Rules involved. Which one is before us?
The before you would be the December 1st, 1983 one. The one was in effect at trial.
The second one?
That was the second one. I believe that was the one in front of it, the one that the court struck down as being overly restrictive.
And that's the one that's
I believe, and that is my consider. I don't believe the other one is before you because the only issue there would have been damages, that he somehow exceeded his authority and he found no damages against us. I mean, you found us to have acted in good faith, or at least arguably in good faith.
What is the content of that? You described that rule in your opening remarks as one that prevented marriages between inmates. Is that its limitation, or
no,
does it?
Inmate marriages. I wasn't clear on that. Although the Eighth Circuit found that the evidence showed that it was only used against inmates, it's stretch was toward everybody. It could affect civilians and would affect civilians. It was not intended to not affect civilians. I don't think...
Well, not two civilians who wanted to get married.
No, of course not. Civilians who wanted to come in and marry inmates. That would be a little beyond our...
Take it as the Eighth Circuit construed it?
I would say that that was the issue before the Eighth Circuit was inmate-to-inmate marriages, but I in my brief I point out that it did have it could conceivably be it could have been applied to civilians, and so I didn't want to mislead anybody.
Well, could I ask have your rules been changed to conform to this judgment?
Yes, we were under order to negotiate or submit separate rules.
There was no stay or anything.
There was an initial stay filed concerning when the initial order came down. We then negotiated the order, the court
so
placed...
The rules now in effect aren't the rules that were invalidated.
Right. We're working
well,
under...
Why isn't the case moot?
Okay. The case isn't moot because given the opportunity we would go back to the other rule if
so you operated, you put them in under compulsion.
We put them in under compulsion and on the basis of administrative there were some tactical concerns for our administration of our prison because this is our first regulation ever struck down, and we had some administrative problems that we felt would cause us to have more difficulty later, I mean in the implementation than to just appeal it and fight it. We were under compulsion. We would go back immediately to prior approval.
What is the marriage rule now in effect?
We have a right to counsel inmates. The superintendent can counsel them not to get married. But we cannot stop the marriage unless the ceremony in some way would interfere with the security of the institution.
You take the position that you can have reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions
30 days,
on any marriage.
Right, on
ceremony.
The ceremony. On the ceremony. We couldn't stop the decision itself. Right.
But now that's the rule that you put in under compulsion, isn't it?
Right. The rule before was that we could actually stop a person from making the decision to get married. And if I might, since we're on the subject, I might go into that a little bit.
But before you move to that,
okay.
I'm looking at some of the findings of fact by the district court. They're not very favorable to you.
They're not.
And they were not found to be clearly erroneous by the Court of Appeals. The one I want to ask you about is number 7 on page 821. I think I can, it's just a couple of sentences. The Wren's rule against inmate-to-inmate correspondence is enforced without a determination that the security or order of Wren's or the rehabilitation of the inmates would be harmed.
Okay.
What do you say to that finding of fact? In other words, the indication is that the courts below concluded that the rules were enforced without any reason whatever.
Well, the court found it. We contended that we did have a security reason for it. That's one of the reasons we have challenged them as clearly erroneous. We believe it came from a misconception of the law, although this one wouldn't have come from because it was a strict finding of fact. You're in a difficult position when you take findings of fact. I mean, he found that we did not do the kind of inquiry that he expected us to do.
Is he asking? I read that as requiring a case by case inquiry.
And in fact, the testimony was we did it. I think the sticking point with the district court is that they didn't refer to the file each time. I mean, we explained that the theory was you go to the file and talk to the
But if,
the
if as a matter of law, you're not required to make a case-by-case determination to apply those rights, this finding of fact is meaningless.
If we're not required to do that. Now, we felt at the district court level that's what we intended to do, and they did it by not necessarily reference to the file every time, but they tried to make a case-by-case base because that's the way the system would work better. I would agree that this was an incorrect, I mean, that it wasn't, we weren't required to do that under constitutional law at this point.
Mr. Herschel, how could a marriage hurt the state of Missouri?
Could hurt the state of Missouri?
Yeah. What harm is there in marriage two inmates?
There is no harm in marriage unless it affects a fundamental interest or a legitimate penological interest, like, for example, security. There is evidence.
How would it affect security?
Okay, at security in prison, you're dealing with a prison here. It's a kind of an unreal world. You're dealing with people who do not develop relationships, who have had histories of abuse, especially in the women's prison, and have had a usually abusive situation with men. The situation is that the fact that they will get married develops love triangles, develop the sorts of
well, they won't live together.
The competing affection, the whole point that most of these people meet from, let's say, Missouri State Penitentiary and at Wren's, which are 30 miles distant, and that doesn't mean that they don't live together, but somebody else can still want to correspond with the same woman. Then we have an extra problem over MSP to keep these people controlled. Or, for example, the woman may change her mind. When a woman would, for example, say she was going to marry one man, decide she's going to marry another man, we then have a problem between those two men. The decision to be married in this situation, granted, is a decision that's done in the abstract because all the other instances of marriages are not permitted. Or not permitted, but are restricted, really, by the fact of incarceration, the family decisions.
Mr. Herschel, this is a collateral question. Do you permit conjugal visits?
No. We permit contact visits, not between inmates, but contact visits between civilians and inmates. At Wren's, we permit contact visits. Did I answer your question?
Heard what you said.
All right, let me explain it this other way. In Zabaki versus Redhale, the decision was that you had a decision to be married was an important right and a fundamental right, and that was because all the other instances of marriages were permitted, and it seemed silly not to permit the decision itself. or protect the citizen, the citizen itself. In this situation, you have a mirrored, just the mirror image of it. In this situation, we have to restrict by the fact of incarceration most of the instances of marriage, and the fact that they can't cohabitate, the fact that their decisions about marriages are changed. All we want to restrict in the decision to be married is if it affects our security interest or if it affects our rehabilitation interest. However, the district court did not accept our rehabilitative interest in this. We still believe that we can have a fundamentally good impact on women by at times restricting their decision to get married in the Renz Correctional Center. And we're not dealing with the Missouri State Penitentiary or any other place. We're dealing with the Renz Correctional Center because that was at issue, although the regulation would have system-wide, but the testimony was about Mr. Turner's decisions. He felt that he was assisting women to gain self-initiative because they were in a particularly special condition. They were from abused situations, they lacked education in most cases, and that we acknowledged that they had had a life that was the result of a sexist existence, and that's what he was attempting to recognize, not that he was attempting to be sexist in his approach.
Now, but if this were an all-male prison, you'd still be making the same argument here, would you not?
We would be making the same, we probably wouldn't, it's hard to say, to decide whether or not Mr. Turner would have said the same thing about men, because he might have had men in different situations.
But your
women
rules
who are
apply,
in prison are different.
Your rules apply across the board.
Right, I hope I didn't make that clear. It would be the same clear, and we would feel that we could stop a man's decision to be married on the same basis that have affected the security interest. In that situation, it might be a scam. It might be a setup to set some sort of a deal up between them, even with a civilian, on a drug scheme to get money into the prison. And because a woman would marry
Mr. Herschel, your time has expired.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll hear now from you, Mr. Finn.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. What we have in this case today involves the prison's denial of a recognized fundamental right that at least applies to the free world, which is not inconsistent with incarceration. Both marriage and correspondence were denied at Renz Correctional Center under a vague best interest standard. If the court reverses this case outright, then effectively what happens is that Mr. Turner and the officials at Renz Correctional Center, who arrogate to themselves the right to decide which of their charges will be married and who can write letters to each other, will effectively have no judicial review of their conduct. They will be effectively the final arbiters of these important decisions that are well recognized in the jurisprudence of this country. I think it's important to note that we have here a prison administration at Renz with a history of abuse of the discretion that it's been given. As the court below pointed out, because, Justice Scalia, in this particular case, we have one institution that was violating the department-wide rules.
I mean, the rules are good or bad. It's a different case if you're bringing a suit about their abuse of discretion. It seems to me the rules are good or bad.
Well, yeah.
I don't see what relevance it has that they may have abused discretion in the past. I mean, I thought it was common practice to place conditions upon parolees, for example, that they not maintain contact with other convicted felons during the term of their parole. Is that not a fairly common condition upon parole?
Yes, sir, I think that is.
Well, now, if that can be placed upon a parolee, why is correspondence with other convicted criminals while he's in the prison so clearly a violation of a fundamental right?
Well, Justice Scalia, I'm not aware of any Supreme Court case recognizing that as an appropriate decision that will stand up. So this is the first time that this court will have an opportunity to rule on the decision of two persons to remain in contact, either inmates or parolees.
So you would agree then that that agreeing with you on this would cast doubt on the validity of restrictions upon parolees being in contact with convicted felons?
Yes, sir. To answer your earlier question, sir, about why the facts of this particular case were important, we had here a prison administrator who was violating the rules of the Department of Corrections. He had his own little fiefdom.
That's not the basis on which the Court of Appeals gave you relief, is it? They said that the regulations were bad.
On their face.
On their face.
Yes, sir.
So what's the fact that he may have violated his own internal regulations got to do with the issues that are before us?
The state is arguing that the entire findings of fact of the district court should be thrown out because the prison administrator should have discretion. And to the Chief Justice's question about the whether the factual findings of the court below are even relevant, point out that what happened and the ability of this particular prison administrator to exercise his discretion is relevant to the decision of this court. If you've got somebody who's violating his own rules, who in this case actually was violating the Procunia versus Martinez case by stopping the correspondence of inmates with outsiders, totally innocent correspondence, then you've got someone who I contend cannot be trusted to enforce the rules fairly.
Well, so you say this case comes up in a totally different posture than identical regulations from, say, Kansas, because there you might have had an administrator who didn't violate his own regulations.
Yes, sir.
The Eighth Circuit certainly didn't treat it that way.
Well, it was argued that those points were argued to them as well, sir. You see, there was a conclusion of law by the court below that the regulations were arbitrarily and capriciously applied here, and that finding was not appealed.
There's no such thing as good or bad regulations in and of themselves.
I'm not arguing that at all. What I am arguing is that when you look at the application of the rules in this case, it's a reason not to trust this administrator with that much discretion.
Well, but
what if the state agrees to replace the administrator? I mean, do we know that they're going to have the same administrator?
No, we don't. And we don't know that we're going to have the same problem. I mean, Justice Scalia...
Was the lower court's determination limited to this rule as applied by this administrator?
No, sir, it was not.
Did it say that the state could adopt the rule so long as it put in a new administrator or when it got a new administrator?
No, sir, it was not.
Then evidently it didn't rule what you said it ruled. The administrator seems to have nothing to do with its decision.
Well, the Court of Appeals focused on the rule itself. But my only point was that the district court also had a separate finding, a conclusion of law, which was not appealed, that this particular administrator acted arbitrarily.
Do you need that to win?
No, sir.
Well, why are you arguing it?
In response to questions, Chief Justice Marshall.
No, I think you started this.
Well, I made a mistake then. In this particular case, we found that there was very little evidence to support the arguments of the state of Missouri. In regard to correspondence, for example, there was a contention made that we promulgated this rule because of security. But in fact, the evidence at trial was that none of the letters which were stopped for a reason having anything to do with security. In fact, when inmates asked to correspond, there was no discussion, no going back and reviewing the file about whether or not this particular inmate might pose a threat to the inmate he's corresponding with or someone else. The flat rule that was stated in the Wren's Correctional Center handbook is inmates may not correspond with anybody who is not a family member. So we had, in this case, a flat denial of correspondence between particular inmates who had no desire to correspond about anything other than simple friendship. In fact, Justice Marshall, your point was well taken about the state's concession that there was no alternative means of communication between these inmates. That, in fact, was the case. If an inmate wanted to write to a friend he knew on the outside, for example, at Wren's, that the rule as applied would not let that inmate correspond.
Mr. Finch, I still don't understand how this argument goes to whether the rule is valid. What you're telling me is that the rule was not being applied fairly. It was not being applied in such a way that
that you were allowed to correspond as the rule said you would, and as we've been told was the purpose, so long as there's no security problem. But that means that the administration of it was bad. And as I read the opinion that we're reviewing here, it says the rule is bad, even if it were honestly applied. And isn't that what you're arguing, that the rule is bad?
Yes, sir, I am. Because you give too much vagueness when you put in a standard of best interest. There is no standard to guide the prison administrator. They have other rules which allow in the prison administration to stop correspondence which, say, is writing about escape attempts or a fraud of some kind. All those things are covered. But the vague best interest standards allows the prison administrator to do anything he darn well pleases in regard to the correspondence of inmates. And we had testimony.
Some applications of the rule would surely be valid.
Your Honor, there.
Vagueness to be invalid for vagueness would require that there are no applications that you could understand.
Well, Justice White, if there is a circumstance where you could validly stop two inmates from writing because of their best interest, there's no evidence of it in the record below. None of the letters that were stopped had anything having to do with security or an escape attempt, and we've reproduced some of them in the brief.
Well, it doesn't just relate to the letter, as we've been told. It may relate to the inmate from whom it came. Maybe he was a troublemaker. I mean, what the prison is trying to do is to say, we don't want to have to review all of this mail so intensively. So we can't possibly catch all of the things that might be in it. So we're simply going to eliminate the correspondence between bad actors. Now, for all we know, the examples you give, although the particular letter was quite harmless, that letter may have come from a very bad actor, from a gang head in another prison. Isn't that possible?
Justice Scalia, I'm afraid there's no evidence of that in the record of this case. The state never presented testimony that the particular correspondent was a member of the gang or had any reason to cause any harm to the security of either institution. These were simply letters of friendship, many of them simply love letters, between a female inmate at Wren's and a male inmate someplace else. And I stress, this is the only institution where you had this problem. If a male inmate at the Missouri State Prison wanted to write to a male inmate at Moberly, that sort of correspondence was routinely allowed. Now, perhaps the state could impose restrictions on gang members, but the Department of Justice study, which is cited in the briefs in this case, points out that 93% of the Missouri inmates are not members of gangs. So the effect of this rule is you stop most of the prisoners in Missouri who don't cause any problems from corresponding because you don't want to read their mail because some of them might be gang members. And I would suggest that if the state's been able to quantify that 6.7% of their members are gang members, they must know pretty well who they are, and they can limit their correspondence.
Let me just be sure I understand one thing. You then do not contend that the Constitution restricts the warden to the only permissible way to do it would be item by item censoring of the mail. You would agree, I take it from your most recent argument, if they identify gang members and disperse them among different institutions because they represent a threat, they could ban all mail between those people without bothering to look at it.
Your Honor,
if they have some reasonable basis for identifying a person as a particularly dangerous inmate, they can say nobody can correspond with him if he's in a different institution.
Well, yes, Justice Stevens, to put it in the terms of the court, of the strict scrutiny test, I think the state would have a compelling state interest, and there may be no least restrictive alternative way of stopping the correspondence which may be harmful between the prison, the gang member at MSP, and the gang member at
Nova. And would you agree that the warden would have a fairly broad discretion in deciding who belongs in the 7% class as opposed to the 93% class?
Well, I think you're going...
You have to have some kind of a reason, I suppose.
There has to be some kind of reason. And frankly, Your Honor, I suggest the best reason is an example of conduct that you don't want to have occurring in the mail. And an instruction, or perhaps an instruction to kill an inmate, or perhaps even just an instruction or the use of a code by one inmate.
But do you think you have to wait till you find something in the mail? Or what about, say, you have a gang form in Institution A and they decide to disperse them to five different institutions just for general security reasons, but they've never gotten any correspondence. Could they right away impose a a ban on those people writing to one another?
I think they could, Justice Stevens. And then the question would be, what happens if an inmate at MSP wants to write to someone else, and he wants to write a totally innocent letter? I think under those circumstances, if the prison administrator can read the letter and say, gee, we don't see anything here that's wrong with this letter, then that inmate should be allowed to send it to someone who's not a gang member. But the rule you suggest, allowing all correspondence to be denied for particular inmates, would still suffer from that vice. Perhaps the inmate's got a cousin who would not fit within the Missouri rules as to who is an immediate family member. He'd like to write to his cousin about his sister's birth of a child. There's no reason that that letter should be stopped, merely because of the speculation that on some other occasion this same inmate might write something that would harm the security of the institution.
Well, of course, you're then insisting on a case-by-case and almost letter-by-letter analysis, which the department says we don't have the personnel to do. Do our cases suggest that there has to be a case-by-case determination and a letter-by-letter? Certainly the opinion in Jones suggested you could adopt a prophylactic rule if you perceived a danger.
Yes, Your Honor, but Mr. Chief Justice, but the opinion in Jones also recognized that inmates do retain those certain fundamental rights. And if you adopt a prophylactic rule that says none of the residents of MSP are going to be allowed to correspond with anyone else, in the absence of any evidence that any resident of Wren's Correctional Center is a member of a gang, then you're violating everybody's rights.
Are you saying that it is a fundamental right established by our cases that prisoners have to correspond with other prisoners?
No, sir. I don't think that this court has ever reached that.
I don't think it has either.
Well, then what's the basis for your insisting on strict scrutiny?
Because, Justice White, I believe that the fundamental right should be recognized in this case. That prison authority.
So you are arguing that there is a fundamental right of prisoners to correspond with one another.
Yes, that's what I think the court should adopt in this case. That there are certain core rights, such as the right
of a
written
word. Well, is Martinez the closest case for you or not?
Yes, sir, it is. Martinez is clearly the
why isn't Jones a more appropriate standard in this case for inmate-to-inmate correspondence, just as it was for inmate-to-inmate meetings?
Well, there is some...
Martinez had to do with the rights of non-inmates, really. And I wonder whether Jones doesn't provide the appropriate test.
That is the state's argument, Justice O'Connor. But in Jones, there was a specific discussion of the First Amendment rights of inmates to solicit one another for membership in a prison. And what this court said was, the prison officials do not have to allow mass mailings, but the court recognized that that's because there can still be individual mailings. That channel of communication is not cut off. And we view that as authority for the position we're arguing in this case. When Leonard Safley, one of the named plaintiffs, wanted to write a letter to his fiancée, P.J. Watson, it didn't do any good to tell him he might be able to write to somebody else because he had a particular target of that correspondence. And Jones recognizes that existence of no other alternative is what's important. The court did use a least restrictive analysis in Jones as regard to the First Amendment issue. And I'd also point out that the court said First Amendment rights are barely at issue in this case. Well, back in Pell, this court held that the inmates do have some First Amendment rights which are not inconsistent with incarceration. And the states conceded that they let at least 25% of the inmates write, so it's clear that the mere fact of correspondence is not inconsistent with incarceration. It's what's in the letter itself, and the only way you determine what's in the letter is by reading it. I would suggest there's no real evidence that the state of Missouri can't handle whatever security problems that it thinks may exist. After all, these rules have been in effect for 30 months. There's been no effort to go back to the district court in this case and say, Judge Sachs, we can't handle this problem. We can't deal with security concerns.
The
state is challenging the whole basis on which the regulations were imposed.
That's right, Chief Justice.
I mean, I would think that perhaps if they lose here, then would be the opportunity to go back to the district court. But until then, I would think their basic approach is the district court and the Court of Appeals were wrong in imposing the regulations they did.
And in fact, perhaps they may do it at that point, Mr. Chief Justice, but the problem is at the present time, they have not encountered such a serious problem that they did go back and try to get a change of the rule in the district
Council,
court.
Counsel, have there been any marriages?
Yes, sir. Many people have been married.
How many?
I don't know. At least 10 that I am aware of. But I have not tried to keep track of all the marriages that have occurred in Missouri prisons.
Now, Mr. Finch, what if this were not just a prison rule, but what if it was a statute enacted by the legislature that said we're adding to all the punishments that we now have on the books, in addition to 20 years or whatnot, anyone who's convicted of a crime will not be able to correspond with other inmates of penal institutions. I mean, avowedly making it part of the punishment. Would that be bad? Is there any difference between that and this situation?
Well, certainly there's a difference in that you've got a legislative enactment and not simply a particular prison administrator at one point. But Judge, Justice Scalia, I don't think there's any substantive difference. I would argue that that statute would also be unconstitutional because of what I believe is an inmate's right.
Can take a man out of his home, out of his family, prevent him from contact visits with his family even. All of the other fundamental liberties can be taken away as a punishment for crime, but the ability to correspond with other felons who are in prison is so fundamental that that can't be imposed?
Yes, sir, I would
say. Seems very strange.
There are certain things, such as communication, the ability to keep open lines, the ability to practice one's central religious beliefs is something that could not be taken away by state statute. And the ability of a person to marry the person of his choice also should not be taken away by state statute. So long as this court recognizes in its opinions that inmates retain certain rights, then the question becomes what rights are they and how can they be protected? If the court were to simply say as a final matter, well, inmates have no rights, and in this case they have no correspondence rights, they have no marriage rights, and in a case that's the Shabazz case that's coming up before this court, they have no religious rights, then we can all go home and there won't be nearly as much prison litigation. But of course, the court has never accepted such a broad proposition.
The court has accepted, of course, the fact that a convicted felon can be deprived of his liberty and his opportunity to live with his family. And these are very fundamental rights. And yet you think the right to correspond with another inmate is more fundamental than that, apparently.
I guess I'll have to answer
yes. Which is a remarkable proposition, I think.
Well, the prison system of this country recognizes the importance of this communication for rehabilitation of an inmate. The regulations that were in effect in this case, in their preamble clauses, always said that communication is important because it gives an inmate something to look forward to. As I mentioned, many of these letters...
But the rule itself says that a prisoner may be granted leave for inmate-to-inmate correspondence if it's determined to be in his best interests or
yes,
hers.
That's right.
And we're talking about the validity of the rule facially. And what's the matter with that rule facially?
Because it is unduly
under
vague.
Under your theory.
Well, ma'am, Justice O'Connor, under my theory, it's wrong because it gives too much discretion to prison authorities to deny a letter solely because they don't like the content. And in fact, there was one letter which was stopped because the prison administrators did not like the content of what was said. There was other correspondence that were stopped because a former inmate who had been released from prison was a, quote, writ writer, unquote, and prison authorities didn't want her writing back into her inmates.
So the facial challenge boils down to a vagueness argument.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I apologize. The other issue, of course, in this case is the right of prison officials to stop inmates from marrying one another. The state has correctly pointed out that there are inmates under the prior rule and under the current, I guess there have been three rules in effect. The first rule was a rule that said inmates, basically said inmates can get married as soon as the prison officials work out the arrangements. Now, ironically, in this particular case, Superintendent Turner took it upon himself to stop inmates. Even though there was a rule that allowed inmates to be married, he stopped certain inmates from getting married because, in his opinion, the marriage was not a good idea. Then, about a month before the trial was scheduled and 3 months before the trial actually occurred, the state of Missouri set up a new system where an inmate had to come up with some compelling reason for allowing him to get married.
Which version of the rule do we have before us on the no marriage?
Well, the current rule, if you're at...
What is before this court, do you suppose?
There
are three different versions, and I'm not quite clear which one we're addressing.
Justice O'Connor, the last rule before the court, before the trial, was a rule that said an inmate can only be married if he comes up with a compelling reason that the marriage should be allowed.
Is that the one we have to deal with?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
The rule that was written by the Missouri Division of Corrections after the case went to trial and the judgment was rendered allows inmates to be married basically at the convenience of the prison administration. They file a request, and they are allowed to be married when it is convenient and under certain restrictions. The restrictions is the number of inmates who may attend, the visitors, that sort of thing.
Now, your problem with this one is not that it's vague, or is it? Your attack on this is a bit different from your attack on the other one, isn't it?
Justice Kelly,
compelling
it
is reason is less vague, certainly, than the conditions for allowing prison mail, which were unspecified.
Yes, sir. I would agree that it is vague. I do not suggest that there is a common method of understanding. We asked the various prison administrators who testified what their definition was, and they did not come down to exactly the same thing. For example, defendant Blackwell testified that financial considerations would be good enough to allow two inmates to get married. But Warden Weirich testified that the only reason he'd allow two people to get married is if they already had an illegitimate child and to give the baby a name.
Well, you might ask the nine of us what constitutes a least onerous alternative, and we might all come up with different answers to that. But it's a standard anyway, just as compelling reason is a standard.
Yes, sir, it is. And I return to the proposition that I don't think that prison authorities should have the power, in the absence of some compelling reason that they advance, and in the absence of showing there's no other way around the problem, a least restrictive alternatives analysis, to stop two consenting adults who satisfy the statutes of Missouri from getting married. Justice Powell pointed out earlier that the findings of fact in this case, particularly findings of fact number 7, do not support the argument of the state in this case. And that is a matter which I would like to deal with. As you pointed out, sir, the district court heard testimony over 5 days from 30-some different witnesses and had the opportunity to listen to Mr. Turner explain why he denied marriages, had the opportunity to hear Defendant Engelbrecht testify about the way he handled correspondence. And under those circumstances, his findings of fact are entitled to great weight. Those were then affirmed by the Court of Appeals. And the state, even though it's just arguing in its brief, still contends that this court should go back, reverse all the findings of fact by the trial court, and presumably enter its own findings at this level. I would suggest that the findings of fact are entitled to particular deference in this case. When we had Defendant Turner on the stand in the court itself, it cross-examined this man about why he was denying marriages and the standards used for denying correspondence.
Mr. Finch, is it clear? You know, we've said that the right to get married is a fundamental right, but the ordinary marriage has a lot of attributes to it that this marriage here would not. I mean, what is left of the associations of marriage? Not the right to cohabit, not the right to beget and rear children in the prison context, right? So it's basically just demonstration of commitment to someone, which might be made in other ways, right? And I suppose there are inheritance effects if the two people get married. What other attributes of the normal marital relation continue to exist in the prison context?
Well, Justice Scalia, if you ask the inmates here why they want to get married, they give, in my opinion, a compelling response, because they want to share their life with someone, even if it's only by mail.
But they don't. I mean, in fact, they don't share their life with one another. They still live apart.
For one thing, Your Honor...
I mean, couldn't they make that commitment just as well by sending them a fraternity ring?
I don't think that the religious attributes of the marriage ceremony can be fairly equated with the fraternity ring. It seems to me, sir, that we must also recall that these inmates are not, in most cases at least, in prison for life. Leonard Safley, one of the plaintiffs in this case, was in the Kansas City Honor Center and had the opportunity to come down and visit his wife in Wren's Correctional Center, and he did that on a regular basis. Now, admittedly, their marriage at that time may have been limited to letters, sitting together in the visiting room and holding hands and occasional kiss when the guard wasn't looking, but that does not mean that that marriage was any less important or sacred. There are many people who marry perhaps in their 60s or 70s who may not have a sexual relationship, but still have care for the person that they've chosen to spend the rest of their life with. And it may be, as the district court recognized, that these marriages may not all work out. But that fact is constitutionally irrelevant, I would submit, because free people make mistakes and inmates make mistakes, as the state points out, or they wouldn't be in there. But at least they've got a right to try to make a better life for themselves. We had expert testimony that the important thing about the marriage decision is that the inmate is standing up and saying, hey, while I may be incarcerated, I've got a right to look forward to a better life. I've got a right to plan on something after this institution. And the evidence we had in this case is that the inmates who did get married, despite the prison officials' objections, ended up becoming better prisoners.
The prison stopped them from getting engaged?
To the best of my knowledge, there was not something like that, although, Justice Scalia, there was something like that that happened at Wren's, where both men and women prisoners were located. As soon as prison administrators noticed any sort of friendship, more serious than very platonic, they would immediately move the men to another institution. So they were trying to break up any relationship from developing between inmates of the two sexes at that particular institution. So yes, if there was no allowance of allowing two inmates at Wren's to get engaged. In fact, Leonard Safley, in this case, as soon as the prison administrators became aware that there was a friendship between he and his ultimate fiancée, they moved him to another institution. Even when he was gone, however, they wouldn't let the two inmates correspond. And so Mr. Safley didn't know until he came to Judge Sack's courtroom about in 1982 whether she would actually consent to marry him. And that's when, in the courtroom, is when we found out her answer. I think that the prison administration in the state of Missouri can balance the interests of the inmates in correspondence and marriage with their own security needs. I've suggested they have been able to do so. All it takes is a little prodding from the courts. But if this court takes away that prodding by granting too much deference to prison administrators, then we're going to have a series of cases, I would suggest, around the country where...
Your time has expired, Mr. Finch.
Thank you, sir.
The case is submitted.